Welcome back to the Flaws of Attraction podcast on this May summer night, though it's not summer. I just have this thing where I basically consider summer to start when spring starts because the area that I live in, it snows a lot of the year. So I just like to do little mind games with myself to make me feel like summer isn't as short. So it was 25 degrees today. I'm stoked. My throat sounds a little raspy because I have a sore throat. I think I have COVID. I don't know. A little frustrating because my antigen test just says it's negative. I did get vaccinated, so I guess that comes with its own problems. And yeah, we're just gonna get through this intro. I'm not gonna spend too much time on the mic, though. I really hope you guys are doing well. I have something super exciting to announce. I basically announced it last week if you listened to the last episode, but it comes out of a place that I really want to give back to you guys. I feel really empowered and really grateful for this community. And I'm just like really excited that I've been this consistent and that I have listeners that are consistent. That just makes my heart go boom. I don't know who says heart go boom. Is that Nicki Minaj? You make my heart. I think, is that maybe Ella May? I don't know. Anyway, I have announced a giveaway and the giveaway is for you guys. So I'm super excited. The giveaway is a chance to win a 1-year subscription to Dive Through, a mental health app. And then I also will be giving away a $100 gift card to ClassPass. You guys know I'm obsessed with ClassPass. And then also the Night and Day Remedy Bar by Sage. Sage Wellness is like an essential oils brand. And they, you know, the one that you walk by in the mall and you're just like, why do I need essential oils now in my life? But they're actually really good to like help calm you down. And then also I picked up a little, it's called Relaxo Ring, and it's an acupuncture ring for stress management from Sage Wellness as well. So you can enter to win this by doing a couple things. You'll have to go to my Instagram. It's my most recent post. It's a reel. It's my most recent reel, and you'll watch it and the caption says giveaway. So that's how you can find it. But what you have to do is just give me a follow if you're not following me already. Tag a friend in the comments. You can share to your stories for a bonus entry. And then if you can also do me a favor and give me a review of this podcast, I would be so grateful. Reviews are like one of the most important things when it comes to ranking in the podcast world. If you don't get reviews, you don't get ranked. So I'm really trying to drive that forward. But I really, like, at the bottom of it all, I just want to say thank you guys for your listens. And yeah, I wanted to share a little bit about Dive Through too. Dive Through is this mental health app and it's pretty incredible. I've been on it for the past couple months, just kind of seeing what's there. It helps you implement some nice breathing and journaling techniques and routines into your life, as well as it is a really great database for mental health advice. There's a ton of like workshops inside, anything from boundary setting to understanding trauma to even looking at your health during a long distance relationship. There's just like so many different topics and it's incredible. It's also, you know, it's like, it's more attainable than typical therapy. So if you are someone who hasn't been able to find a therapist yet, maybe funds are out of your means or you just don't haven't found the right person, I really recommend looking at this app, not as a replacement, but just as a tool. It's really, really, really good. So anyway, you can enter to win a giveaway. And if not, you can always check out Dive Through below and any of the things that I talked about. And yeah, my throat hurts, so I'm going to stop talking, but I'm going to first introduce my amazing guest. So Simone and I actually went to high school together back like 10 years ago. She was a year younger than me and her sister was a year older than me. So I got to know her and her sister not very well, but just a lot in passing. And I came to find out about a year ago or less, maybe probably less, that she actually has become an Instagram TikTok queen, queen in the mental health and wellness game. And she is known as the Cognitive Corner. And yeah, she's just really great. In this conversation, I bring her on as a psychologist to kind of talk about everything around boundaries, understanding trauma. We talk a little bit about purity culture and religious trauma as well. And yeah, we just talk about a bunch of tools for how to regulate your nervous system. So I'm really excited because I think that this topic is extremely important for us, especially when you're starting to come out of a dissociation and maybe back into your body. But without further ado, we have Simone, and yeah, have a good listen. Hello, Simone. Welcome to the podcast.
Thank you for having me. I'm so excited to be here.
I'm so excited. We have not seen or talked to each other in like 10 years. And it's just cool. Like one day I was on my Instagram and I was like, who is the cognitive corner? And I said, like, oh my gosh, it's Simone. It was really cool to see you flourish and like, I don't know, do what you're doing right now.
Thank you so much. It was so nice to hear from you. It's always nice to hear from, you know, people from high school and all of that kind of stuff. So I'm glad to see that you're doing what you're doing. And I think that this podcast is really important, especially like the theme of religious trauma and all that.
Yeah, no, for sure. Thank you so much. We go back to high school, like you were saying. We both attended a Christian school. Do you want to share a little bit about your cultural background and upbringing and your experience growing up?
Yeah, absolutely. So my cultural background, I am a Black woman, but by ethnicity, my dad is Jamaican and my mom was born in Aruba and grew up in Grenada. And so we're from the Caribbean. And so, yeah, growing up in Alberta, mostly white people, also our shared high school, also mostly white. So yeah, it was definitely like an interesting upbringing, I would say. Definitely centered around like religion and all of that kind of stuff. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. It's so interesting because like my memories of you are far and few between. I think we were really stretched thin because our school was really tiny and was definitely like predominantly white. I think that there was like person of color. Like I can't quantify how many there were, but it was very, very low at the school. Yeah. And so it's funny, like not until like the past couple years, like I went to ACAD after the art college and I also noticed like a tendency for it to be predominantly white, but it started to like really come into my lens when I started to dance. Like I started competitively dancing with a group of people that were predominantly not white, mostly Filipino. And that's when I started to be like, oh my gosh, this would have been so difficult to go through education systems that are like this. So did you have a good experience or was it like... Okay.
I would say like I didn't know any better necessarily. I think that all my life I've grown up kind of in predominantly white areas. And then after high school and then in university, I would say after university, I was kind of like, okay, I really started to then find kind of my identity as a Black woman, because I think it's definitely a little bit more difficult when you grow up predominantly around white people and then you're not really exposed to culture as much or, you know, people of color. And like you had said, in our school, there was very few, maybe a handful. And I think there was maybe 4 or 5 people of color in my own graduating class, right? And so, yeah, I don't think that that's something that I necessarily saw as front and center in my experience. And then as I grew older, I was like, okay, how I navigate the world is different because I am a person of color. And that's not something that I necessarily recognized as much before.
Right. Yeah, yeah, that makes sense. And then in terms of religion, was your family religious like from birth, or did you kind of find Christianity or whatnot through your journey through school?
Yeah, so from birth, like we grew up going to church and all of that kind of stuff. So yeah, even prior to our shared high school, I was in the Catholic system.
Okay, yeah, totally. Yeah. That's crazy. Cool, yeah. That's awesome. So now you are a therapist. Yeah. Do you want to share a little bit about like what brought you to therapy?
Yeah, so I wasn't entirely sure exactly what I wanted to do after high school. I knew that maybe like the realm of psychology was something that I was interested in. So I took a year off after high school and then I decided that I wanted to move away. I wanted to move out from my parents. And so I moved with my friend to Red Deer, which again, another predominantly white city, and decided to just enroll in the social work program because they didn't have a psych program there at the time and there wasn't anything I was necessarily super interested in. And then throughout the social work program, I was kind of juggling between law and pursuing like my master's in social work. And after I started studying for the LSATs, I was like, no, this is not for me. So then I started learning more about mental health, and then I had like friends and family members that were kind of going through their own mental health stuff at the time. And so it also hit close to home. So it was easy for me to be very interested in like, okay, what is all this kind of stuff about? And then in addition to that, my mom was also in psychiatric nursing. So that gave me some exposure pretty early on to mental health. And yeah, from there, I started just doing practicums in the areas that I was really interested in. And so I did some on the psychiatry unit in one of the hospitals here in Calgary. And from there, I was like, okay, I think that this is sort of my area.
Right. Yeah. Okay, that's incredible. That's so interesting. Did you, like, when you were getting interested in therapy, you said that you had family that was directly impacted and friends that were directly impacted. But did you ever have, like, a spark to explore therapy before you went to school for it yourself?
Never, honestly. It did not even cross my mind. Honestly, mental health wasn't even something that I, like, really thought much about. I would say that therapy really came into my realm. I think it was probably right after my bachelor's is when I first started going to therapy. And I was like, okay. And during that time too, I was like, it's really hard to find someone who's like a person of color as a therapist. So again, it's like a predominantly white field. And I felt good about the services that I experienced for the most part, but I never, I think, really felt like seen and heard in some of my experiences until I was able to find a Black therapist a few years later. But yeah, it definitely wasn't something that was front and center in my mind at all, because although mental health was something that was in my family, so to speak, because of my mom's profession, it wasn't something that was like very like talked about very much.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's so fascinating. I have a friend who, she's of like Asian heritage, and she essentially was like showing me, she was like, I'm finally interested in going to therapy, Jill, but I can't find an Asian female therapist. And so she finally found one, but it was fascinating because like from my lens as a white woman, I was like, la-di-da, like I'm not particularly looking for that. But something I was looking for was a woman who was close to my age, who was a therapist and studied, who had come out of religion, who had like a religious background. Mm-hmm. And like specifically a charismatic background, because that's like something that I'd experienced, but like who was on the opposite side and was deconstructing and had gone further ahead. And that was like such a crazy criteria for me to find. And I got really lucky in finding that person. But I did find that like I had one or two therapists before who couldn't empathize. Like they hadn't walked in my shoes. And so it was helpful to a degree, and then it wasn't, if that makes sense. I just was like, it is so important for this field to be diverse because of all of our unique walks through lives and all the different nuances we experience. And so yeah, it's great that you're in the field now too. Do you see like a change in the field at all, or do you think that it's still like an upward battle?
I think slowly definitely I'm seeing a change, especially because I think that mental health, especially for the generation that's just previous to us, I think that's definitely something that's talked about a lot more than it was, you know, in our generation. Because even if I think about school, I don't know about you, but I don't remember necessarily talking much, if anything, about mental health. And so I think people are definitely more interested in like, okay, this is somewhere I could see like my career being, and that would provide the representation. So I definitely see that a little bit more, and I definitely also see people accessing services a lot more than maybe a couple of years ago.
Yeah, that's true. I also see it as well. I want to ask you about like your specialties in your field in PTSD. How did you choose your specialty?
Yeah, so I was working at a community mental health organization back in 2016, 2017, and that was kind of my first exposure to trauma, and it was around like domestic violence and all that kind of stuff, and so I really started learning more about it then. And at that point in time, when I started learning about it, I was like, this trauma can impact literally absolutely everything, regardless if it's something that you've experienced as a child or as an adult. And the more that I learned about it, the more I realized that it's kind of just interwoven into a lot of the mental health issues that a lot of people experience today. And so from there, I was like, okay, this is like the area that I want to get my master's in. And so it was nice that U of C had a program that, you know, specialized in trauma-informed practice. And so that's the master's program that I ended up taking. And so from there, I just kind of expanded my credentials in terms of like the trainings that I went to and make sure that all of them were, you know, focused on trauma.
Right. Did you have any wild realizations about your own personal life? Can I ask that while you were going through that program? I feel like I asked that because I know that
there was a stigma that people who go to school for psychology end up like self-diagnosing a ton when they're going through that. I identify with like little T trauma, maybe like mid T trauma to some degree. But yeah, what was your experience going through the program and like reflecting on yourself?
Yeah, I definitely noticed that there was things that I had experienced that maybe I couldn't necessarily put to words before. And that's also why a lot of times when you're in school for whether it's social work or psychology, they recommend that you get your own therapist so that you know the experience before you start to provide services. And so I think that that was really integral for that process for me too, is, you know, if I'm going to show up and be someone else's therapist, I also need to know what's going on for my own history. And because that someone else's story or someone else's things that they bring to the table can also activate things in myself. And if I'm not aware of those things, then I'm not going to be super helpful.
Yeah. Yeah, that's very fair. Do you want to share about the difference between a little T trauma and a big T trauma for our listeners who might be like unsure?
Yeah. So little T trauma can be characterized as things that maybe you might not know are traumas. So things like that are a little bit more nuanced or can get overlooked a little bit easier. So emotional neglect might be one of those things because, you know, it's not something that's like big and like loud, so to speak. It's something that happens gradually over time and creates that response. So emotional neglect might look like, you know, your parents not being able to, you know, help you regulate your emotions, your parents not necessarily taking an interest in the things that you do on a day-to-day basis, you not feeling like you have someone safe to talk to. So those are things that people might go through life and say like, oh yeah, my parents, like they provided a great life for me. They had a roof over my head. Maybe they showed up to my games, but nobody ever asked me how I was doing. Nobody ever really, I didn't feel like anybody cared about my emotional experience. So that might be an example of a little T trauma. And a big T trauma is something that is kind of like more objectively traumatic. So that could be like maybe a car crash or a natural disaster or like physical abuse, emotional abuse, all of that kind of stuff. But what I will say about like the big T trauma and little T trauma is that sometimes I think that it can be, sometimes people can feel a little bit invalidated by some of those experiences, because if they experience a little T trauma and they have like these after effects, whether it's PTSD or it's not, then they're like, well, do I deserve to feel like that? Because my experience isn't, you know, as quote unquote objectively big as someone who experienced a natural disaster or physical abuse or torture or something like that. And so what I like to say about that is just that our nervous systems are in control of what we define as traumatic. So something that is traumatic to me might not be traumatic to you. And it really just depends on so many different contextual factors.
Yeah, it reminds me of purity culture to a degree, because I think for some of us, people who've got an experience purity culture and trauma from that, sometimes it can be hard to like understand that that has had such a big impact on people. I know for me, sometimes I'm like, that feels like, why am I taking this so hard? But like when you understand the layers to it, like in purity culture, like you typically are wiring your brain with shame in regards to your sexuality. So it's like a slow compounding trauma that can result from that. But I find that like at the end, when you pull yourself back, they've been able to relate purity culture trauma with like rape trauma, which is such a huge topic. But like it's not to invalidate that a small compounding trauma can have the same effects as a really intense, horrific one-off trauma. Like it's not, I think like our society, we like to like measure things out and be like, this means this and this means this, but it's a lot more nuanced, like you're saying.
Oh, absolutely. Because I think, you know, even in you talking about purity culture, for example, I think that there can be like a massive difference between, for example, parents who say like, okay, you should remain abstinent, but also teach you about your body and teach you about the natural experiences that you might have as a human being, versus not having any of those, that education, experiencing purity culture and not really knowing, okay, what sensations, what feelings I get, is that normal? Is that not normal? Is that bad? Is that not good? Or what does that look like?
Yeah, totally. I agree. I think it's a lot of like stuff that's kept in the dark that can be really difficult for people. And then they realize that, oh my gosh, this is my body. Like, how do we cultivate a good relationship with our bodies? Something that I'm really passionate about is embodiment practices and like dropping into your body, which is, I think like you hear that term more like on the spiritual kind of like energetic work side. But I do think there is so much validity to it, because therapy has been so life-changing for me, like to be able to process. I do CBT therapy with my therapist to verbally process and to like watch myself spiral or go through all of those things. But like to be able to develop a relationship with what my body is saying, I think that's like just an extra beautiful layer of like how you can integrate psychology work.
Oh, absolutely. And that's honestly one of the main modalities that I use is somatic-based psychotherapy. And that's, you know, bridging the connection between your mind and body, because your body tells you so many things that are going on for you. But oftentimes, whether it's because of trauma, whether it's because of, you know, the fact that mental health education hasn't really been much of a thing in the past little while, or whatever it is, sometimes that connection can get fuzzy. And we don't know when we feel uncomfortable, or sometimes it's just like the basic things like feeling hungry or thirsty or needing to go to the bathroom that we've ignored because we've had to at some point.
Right. Okay. Crazy. So, okay, what are your credentials? Like, I was looking at all your little like letters beside your name, and I was like, I don't know what that is. Can you share a little bit about like somatics and what other practices you're registered in?
Yeah. So the letters behind my name, the BSW stands for Bachelor's of Social Work, MSW stands for Master's of Social Work, and then RSW stands for Registered Social Worker. And so then you can take different trainings afterwards or kind of during school, depending on where you are in school. So I took a course on somatic-based psychotherapy. I'm also trained in accelerated resolution therapy. I've taken a course in internal family systems, which is really nice too for trauma. So those, I think, are the three main modalities that I use. Mm-hmm.
Okay, crazy. So how often does religious trauma pop up?
I would say that no one has ever come specifically for that, but I definitely see it interwoven a lot of times. So I will see it with, you know, people who might be experiencing feelings for the same gender, let's say, and, you know, they feel conflicted about it. And because maybe they either are currently religious or have a previous history with religion and the values don't necessarily align. And so that can cause a lot of inner turmoil. And usually it's really just about working with the shame that comes with that, because the shame is usually the thing that compounds everything.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that makes sense. Shame, it seems to be, I mean, it's not like religious trauma specific. Shame is something that exists in so many different areas. So when you see shame pop up in the work, like, is there a way that you process with your clients, I guess, how to unwind that? Or is it just a very gentle, like ever-going type of integration of getting shame out of the way?
I think it's a little bit of both. I think the first and foremost, I like to just call attention to it and start to notice when that pops up. So first of all, you know, what does shame feel like in your body? How do you know when you're feeling that? And then what experiences bring that out for you? So noticing, you know, on a day-to-day or week-to-week basis, and that's why kind of the outside of therapy work is really important, is noticing like, okay, things that I maybe didn't think made me feel shame, that's when it comes up. And so really digging into some of those experiences of like, okay, why might we feel shame about those things? And at the root of it, the thing is that we don't necessarily feel like we're deserving of love or connection or any of those things for whatever reason it is, right? And so it's really unpacking that intrinsic, especially if that's never been established. So if it's never been established, then we're kind of, you know, working from the bottom up. Right. And uncovering like, okay, what about you do you feel like, or can we build up to be intrinsically worthy? Mm-hmm. Not necessarily about who you're attracted to or who you're in relationship to or whatever else.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that could be really difficult for someone experiencing same-sex attraction, especially if they feel like that is something that they can't go forward with because of certain values. So that would be really difficult. I think when you're talking about shame, it reminds me of shadow work. Do you ever, like, what do you think about shadow work?
Yeah, I don't know a lot about it. I know I've heard the term, but yeah, I'd love to hear more.
Yeah, from my experience, shadow work is like, you identify things that you may not have looked at previously. So for example, something that's just popped up for me, and this is deep because it is like a charged word, is the word unlovable. I went through a situation a week or two ago where I was really triggered in my inner child. My nervous system was derailed for like 3 or 4 days, and the core, I was able to identify the word that was making me feel that way was the word unlovable. So I'm assuming shadow and shame work probably are very interwoven and intertwined, because with shadow work, essentially what you do is you identify what charge there is in a certain word, and then you work on like integrating and like discharging that word. So you're like, okay, unlovable, like that's not true. Let me find all the ways in my life where I can start to see that I am lovable, instead of like following the network that cognitively reinforces this idea that I'm not that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. I would definitely say that those two are parallel. I think maybe the only difference is for me when I work with clients with shame, I work a lot with like nervous system regulation in terms mm-hmm. of like the window of tolerance. So just briefly, just for those who might not know what the window of tolerance is, essentially it's a model for understanding your nervous system. So when you're in your window of tolerance, you are feeling regulated. You can kind of think and feel at the same time. It doesn't necessarily mean that you're happy. It just means that, you know, if life's frustrations or things come your way, you feel like you can deal with it. Mm-hmm. When you're outside of your window of tolerance in hypoarousal or hyperarousal, you're going to be, your nervous system is activated, you know, your amygdala is on fire, your prefrontal cortex is turned off, so you can't make any logical decisions, anything like that. And so it's really about, typically when we experience those feelings of shame, we're immediately out of our window of tolerance. And so it's about, how do I sit with that feeling gradually and get back to that window of tolerance? That's, and so those so are things hard. That it is, yeah. And so that's, you know, the thing in therapy is like, okay, how can we sit with this feeling of shame and then use co-regulation, so like myself and the client regulating together in order to build up the tolerance to like feel that a little bit and then bring us ourselves back down.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So it doesn't feel overwhelming. So I can say like, oh, eventually at least you can say, okay, this is what maybe previously brought me that feeling of shame, but it doesn't feel dysregulating. It feels a little bit uncomfortable, but it doesn't feel dysregulating.
Wow. Okay. So that's the goal. What, okay. This is so relevant for me because I was so dysregulated last week and I haven't experienced mm-hmm. that in like 2 years. So, you know, mm-hmm. I had to kind of figure out, and it, for me, it wasn't related to religious trauma, though I'm sure that this pops up for people in religious trauma and purity culture all the time. The observance of my nervous system getting outside of that window of tolerance, like what are some tools that people can use if they can't co-regulate with a therapist?
Yeah. So I think it also really depends on like what zone you're in. So if you're in hyperarousal, typically that's your more emotionally activated, like anxiety, impulsivity, extreme anger might happen in there. Whether versus hypoarousal, that's where like dissociation happens. It's kind of like your freeze sort of response. Okay. So I always like ice pack on the chest. I think that can be really helpful, especially in hyperarousal. Mm-hmm. For hypoarousal, you're going to want to have some sort of activation of your muscles. So if you can kind of get yourself out and up, go for a walk, do something to activate yourself, knowing that you're kind of in that freeze response. Or things that might be helpful are like, I really like acupressure rings. So there's those little tiny rings that have all those little pinpoints on them, and they allow you to kind of feel sensations. So just starting to make sure that you can feel grounded in what's going on in the present.
Mm-hmm. Okay, that's really, really fascinating and makes a lot of sense. Intuitively for me, I was like, I can't stop walking. I was like, I need to go to the gym and just like walk on the treadmill. And I think mm-hmm. that's funny how intuitively your body kind of knows what it needs to do. Mm-hmm. I feel like your body at some times would be like, I need a warm hug, or I need to like have mm-hmm. something on my chest, versus like, I need to get this energy out and like just put it outside of my body by going through walks. Mm-hmm. It's kind of cool to hear that, yeah.
Yeah, it's definitely, I would say it's definitely a cool experience as well, like in sessions, just being able to watch people start to get regulated again, because oftentimes you don't really realize it's happening until like you're like, okay, okay. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Because I know, for example, a really common coping strategy that's known is kind of like the 5-4-3-2-1, where you like notice, you know, five things around you, or five things that you can see, five things that you can feel, all that kind of stuff. And although it objectively seems really simple, it's also very, 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 and that's one of the biggest things that I use is when I noticed clients start to get dysregulated, I'm like, can you tell me a couple of things you can hear in this room right now? And then right. it makes you focus on like, oh, okay, like what's happening here?
Kind of like pulls them outside of their experience. Is that
yeah.
the goal?
Yeah, into the present of like, oh, I can actually hear the lights humming, or I can hear people walking outside, or whatever yeah. else it is. And then your body starts to regulate again.
Mm-hmm. Okay, crazy. Have there been particular practices that you like are your go-to practices if you get dysregulated?
Yeah, I would say like breathing is like first and foremost. So if I notice, I feel like I'm definitely quite in tune with my body now. I do still see a therapist, which I think is really important. But yeah, I feel like I'm quite in tune with my body, so I can definitely notice when I'm starting to get dysregulated. So breathing is definitely one of them. If I'm starting to feel really antsy, definitely going for walks is another one of those things. Or if I'm feeling like I need connection of some sort, then I'll call a family member or a friend or something like that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, for sure. That's amazing. Okay, so you have some incredible courses on the Dive Through app. I want to hear a little bit about Dive Thru. I also want to hear a little bit about the courses and like which ones have your heart, like which ones are your babies and like the ones that you're the most passionate about.
Yeah. So I started working with Dive Thru last June, I think it was. So it's been almost a year already. And so I think what really drew me to the app and Sophie in general, I would say, is just kind of like the no BS attitude towards mental health. I think that they're a company that definitely is not only very inclusive, but also very open to like learning and expanding knowledge and all of that kind of stuff. So I definitely felt like a good fit for myself, because I think the biggest thing in the mental health field as well is, you know, this rhetoric that you have to kind of be this blank slate. Mm-hmm. And that's not how I show up to my practice at all. Like, I'm someone that will like laugh with you in sessions. Like, we can swear if you want to, we can do whatever. It doesn't matter to me, you know? And I think it's really important for connection in order to have that, those traits of your personality come out. And so with Dive Thru, I don't feel like I have to like censor myself, like hide anything. I feel like I can fully show up and be like, I like this, I don't like this, whatever it is. And then there's full support.
Yeah, no, that's incredible. It's amazing. So I am on the Dive Thru app right now, and it's been really, really helpful. I think there's so many apps out there, but so when I got it, I was like unsure. I was like, am I going to use this, right? Like, am I actually going to go through the breathing practice and like their little journaling thing? And what I found is that if I set a time in my day to look at that app, like, it is so helpful. Breathing wise, like, in particular, I think like just the 3 minutes, and it's not like you're doing any crazy form of breath work. It's very much just like, okay, we're gonna breathe for 3 minutes, and then you're gonna write really quickly what your day was like and like identify where your stresses are coming from. And that's it. And I've loved it. I've also loved like looking at your courses and the courses on the app, but I think just like having that touch point when you open the app is so powerful. I'm obsessed with it.
I agree, because it causes you to be present, right? And I think that there's very few things that cause you to be present in the moment. I think a lot of things right now are intended to take our attention away from the present, and so it's nice to like have a second of like, okay, breathe, and what do you feel? Take a second, because we often don't.
Sorry.
Oh, no worries. No worries at all.
Keep on going.
I was just going to say, we often don't give ourselves that time in the day to just take a second to be present.
Totally. Yeah. I got really excited. When you are working with specific clients, do you see like an overall theme that comes through? Like, people are very dissociated, or they're like very much in their brains and not in their bodies. Like, do you sense that with clients, or is that like just more one-offs?
I would say like it's definitely a theme of just being able to understand the emotional experience, because that's not something, where would we have learned that, right? So understanding like, what do emotions feel like in my body? What do they mean? They don't have to be factual in the sense of like feelings are not facts, but they are still valid and they inform our experiences. And so how do I move through some of those things? Because I think that it's easy to deal with emotions with things like avoidance, right? Especially with all the stuff that we have now, like social media and everything. And so really, I think the biggest theme is like, how do I cope with my emotions on a day-to-day basis that is helpful for me?
Okay, that's great. You have a bunch of courses in the Dive Thru app. You have one on looking at trauma. You have another one on boundary setting. You have like quite a few courses. Is there one that you're the most passionate about?
I mean, I think that's a hard question, but I think like, if I really had to think about it, I think perhaps the boundaries one I might have to rank first, just because I think that in that course, I kind of go through the different types of boundaries, which I think that when we think about boundaries just in general, a lot of times we just think of things like when people are like speaking rudely to us, or people aren't treating us in the ways that we want to be treated, which is all totally fair. But I think that there's so many other aspects of boundaries that we don't really think about, like our time and our energy, our emotions, all of that kind of stuff. And I think that those are pieces that it's really important to think about when we are looking to navigate our relationships in general.
Totally. Boundaries is fascinating. The first time I like ever was really thinking about boundaries was, there's a book called Boundaries by Henry Cloud, and I don't, he is a Christian author. I don't personally like go with that title anymore, but it's still like a really valid book. What would be the purpose of developing better boundaries?
So I always say the purpose of boundaries is to create safer relationships. So I think a lot of times boundaries gets a bad rap because people see them as a point of conflict. But I always look at conflict also as an opportunity for connection, because I think that you know, if you think about your relationships where you've had conflict and you've been able to get to the other side of it, typically that just creates intimacy in the relationship. And so when we look at boundaries, we're looking at, okay, how can this relationship be safe for both you and I to show up fully? And so sometimes that does, you know, mean that distance needs to be had. But at other times, it just means that maybe one or both parties has to tweak a few different things in order for both people to really feel safe and comfortable.
That kind of like makes me think about black and white boundaries. Like from my background, I was definitely trained to think very black and white about situations. So like if they don't show up with the character that I want or that I like, whatever, then I just cut them off versus developing permeable boundaries. Do you want to share a little bit about like the different types of boundaries that you can have?
Yeah. So maybe I'll start with like permeable boundaries. So that would be kind of in the gray space of the black and white, right? So that would be when your boundaries are flexible, you might have something that's firm, but depending on, you know, the relationship and you kind of assess as you go about how you feel, and those boundaries can, you know, increase a little bit if they need to, or decrease a little bit if they need to. But when you have rigid boundaries, then you're kind of like a stone wall and nothing is getting through. And it doesn't matter who or what or when, but that boundary is set. And I think that there's a time and place maybe for some of those things, especially if there's, you know, specific limits that you have. But I would say in general, permeable boundaries are the way to go because we want to reassess things on a frequent basis to just make sure that we're comfortable in our relationships. And then on the very other end of that spectrum, you know, absolutely no boundaries. That can also be very harmful for us just because, you know, people may or may not take advantage of us. And if we don't really know the things that we need or the things that we expect from other people, then that can make our relationships really hard and potentially really unsafe as well.
Okay. Yeah. So I see the two sides. I think I've definitely erred in the past couple of years after getting into mental health work on the side of very rigid boundaries. And to be honest, like, I don't think it's been very helpful for me most of the time. I think like what you said, permeable boundaries is the way to go. I think like a lot of that came out of like dating culture and being like, yes, no, like you don't have my time. And like, to be honest, I think that sometimes having a rigid boundary, if it's obviously like an abusive situation, that's great. Like make sure that you're protecting yourself from like non-negotiable behavior. But I think it has allowed for like a bit of avoidance for me too in actually dealing with certain pain because I'm just like, no, you're just cut out. We're never going to talk again. And like, I can see that side. And then on the flip, I see the other side where it's like, why would someone not want to have boundaries with anyone? It's probably like a bid for connection and keeping doors open. And so how would you relate like developing proper boundaries in regards to self-worth? Like what is the work there for us to get to a place where we are maybe monitoring the types of boundaries we need to put in properly?
Yeah, I would say that it kind of goes back to some of that, you know, somatic stuff too. So for example, for me, I know that if I feel uncomfortable, typically I kind of maybe get a pit in the bottom of my stomach or like my heart might start beating a little bit faster, or my hands might get a little bit sweaty. And so being able to assess like, okay, what is it that makes me feel uncomfortable? And maybe taking some inventory of your relationship. So what is it that I really like about maybe my best friend or my parents or my siblings? What is it that I don't like? And how can I navigate those relationships? And starting to communicate. So I think when we think about communicating boundaries, a lot of times, especially if you're not used to communicating it, it can feel really intimidating, which is totally fair. But I would just say, start with taking a pause or just saying like, let me get back to you about things. And then you can create space for yourself to feel comfortable at some point saying like, actually, no, that doesn't work for me. Or no, I can't attend this event. Or, you know, no, I'm sorry. Like I don't feel comfortable lending you money or whatever it might look like.
Yeah. No, that's really, really wise. I love to hear this because I think, yeah, I think like personally for me, and you're on Instagram, you know, you have a lot of infographics and all of that stuff. Something that's popped up in my work with my therapist a lot of the time has been like reading these really black and white infographics, and I'll be like, I'm going through this really nuanced situation where I don't know what to do, and I saw this really black and white infographic that's telling me that I shouldn't do this if I want to be in my highest self-worth. And that has been like a conversation that comes up over and over again, especially because, and I think this is a contribution to me being raised in like a very black and white religious world where I'm like, my worth is like tied to like my black and white rigidity, if that makes sense. And so I've really struggled to find that gray space and to get out of my head and into my body. What would you say for people who are like going through that with the infographics or like all the different information that we get?
Yeah, I think it's definitely important to like practice social media safety in the sense of, especially when you're on kind of like mental health Instagram or mental health TikTok, really treating it like a self-help book, so to speak. So, you know, if you're reading it and you're looking at it, great, but take the things that may be applicable for you and leave the things that may not be. And also remember that this is kind of general information most of the time, and so it doesn't have the nuance of your own unique experiences. So, you know, boundaries for one family might look so different than boundaries for another family. Something that might be completely not acceptable for one person may be completely fine for another person. And either makes that wrong. It's just about who feels comfortable with what. And so I think it's just about remembering, like, okay, when I do see these black and white posts, that this is general information. And if this doesn't feel like it's applicable for my situation, then maybe it's just something that I leave, and that's okay.
Right. That's kind of like a surrender posture. That's really nice. Attachment styles is like a huge topic that I love. I like came to relate with the anxious attachment style, and that book gave me such a huge lens. I know you have a course on healthy relationships and how to implement those. What has been your experience with like healthy relationships in your life and navigating with the tools of attachment theory?
Yeah, so in my life, I definitely fall more on the, I think, disorganized attachment style spectrum. And so kind of like will oscillate between the anxious and avoidant sort of traits. And I think that that's just a lifelong journey, so to speak, in the sense of really understanding what it is that activates your attachment system and how do you find safe relationships and create regulation for yourself, with yourself and with other people. I think that a lot of times when we talk about relationships and attachment and all of that kind of stuff, there's this idea that, okay, before I get into a relationship, I have to focus on this, I have to work on this, and then once I'm like healed or whatever that might look like, I can go into a relationship. But you know, relational problems are healed relationally, I like to say, and they're not healed independently. And so it's easy to, you know, say like, okay, well, I want to work on my anxiety or I want to work on X, Y, and Z. But when you're in relationship to other people, that's oftentimes when these things come out because it's a lack of control. And so, how do I cope with some of those things? And how do I, you know, choose partners that might be able to be like communicative about this thing with me or might be able to assist in maybe like insecurities or, you know, past fears that I've had? And so, I think that when we look at the attachment systems in general, I don't necessarily think that there are people that are always 1000% of the time secure. I think that at times, depending on our situations, we can kind of oscillate into different attachment styles and we don't generally gravitate towards one. But I think it's really about, you know, what relationships in my life do I have that make me feel safe and secure? And are there objective things about this relationship or about this person that are causing me to feel anxious or avoidant? Or is it kind of just some internal stuff that I have to work through?
Yeah, when people are working through internal stuff for themselves, like, do you recommend a journal, like a journaling practice, or like, what are the practices that people can go to where they can become self-empowered to do the work for themselves?
Yeah, I love journaling because I think that it's a great way to not only just process what's going on presently, but also take a look back at the ways that you might have felt or dealt with situations before. And it gives you a more of an objective view about, okay, what was I feeling in those moments? So let's say my friend went on vacation and it feels like maybe they're abandoning me. And so what causes those feelings of abandonment? And where's the root of it? And what did you do in those situations? And so if maybe you reacted in ways that you didn't find helpful in that situation, you can look back and say, like, okay, I know that this same friend or a different friend or my family members are going on vacation, and I know that this might come up for me. So what do I need to do in order to take care of myself?
Yeah, no, that's great. Journaling is a practice that I feel like is the answer for so much of what I need to do, like when it comes to being like a huge piece of that puzzle of somatic regulation. I think like putting words on paper, it's so invaluable, but I struggle to find time to do it. And I think every time I sit down and like I know there's like this rhetoric that writing physically on paper is better for some reason, but I like to type. Like I'm a huge typer, and so I have Notion on my computer, and the other day I was able to pull my computer out and just like freestyle write, and I was able to like take everything that was spiraling in my head and put it on paper and for me to like organize information that way. And I think it was like a release. Like I feel like that information, I stopped spiraling versus before. I don't think I would have unless I used the modality of journaling. I'm a huge fan of it, basically, is what I'm trying to say.
Yeah.
But yeah, what do you think about, like, what's your personal like, relationship with journaling like?
I really like journaling. It's definitely not something that I do as much as I would like to, but especially recently, in maybe the past like 6 months, I've been trying to at least do it on a weekly basis, regardless of how I'm feeling, because I think that one of the big parts of journaling is that people often, it's their go-to when they're upset or sad about things, but I also think it can be really helpful when things are going fine so that you can look at, okay, like what is it also that I value that makes me happy that felt worth writing down at that point. And for some clients, I know that, you know, writing isn't helpful for them, but some people like video journaling. So just saving videos on their computer or whatever it is. And sometimes that can help capture kind of like those raw emotions. And it's, for some, it's really helpful to watch those things back and say like, okay, this is what I was going through at the time. This is what I was really upset or angry about, or this is what I was really happy about. So I think that there's definitely different ways to do it, even with, you know, art or whatever that might look like, or like you said, typing.
No, that's beautiful. I've definitely done the video version before. I remember sharing it with my therapist. She like made fun of me. I had like a weird relationship with a therapist once. Yeah, she was very interesting, but that's why I thought it was helpful for me to like continue to find the proper therapist for me. She didn't really have a good understanding of attachment theory, which I thought was interesting because like I only know that because I have an innate interest in psychology. And so I think like I was sharing with her anxieties and purity culture related stuff, and her response to me was like, do you think that you possibly are a lesbian? And I was like, no, like for me personally, I'm not, like I don't think I fluctuate that much on the spectrum, but like that was her response to me sharing about dissociation with purity culture. So I think it's interesting to look at the psychology world and like it's like an ever-growing thing, and I think like right now there's more tools than ever before. Like there's apps like Dive Through where you can like find information, or there's an app called like Mind, I think by Mark Groves, that is like a bunch of psychologists talking about relationship stuff. So having databases of information is so important. But like, what would you do? What would you recommend for someone who's maybe like has a relationship with a therapist that isn't mutually beneficial?
Yeah, I think it also depends on the comfort level within that relationship. So my go-to is always, if you can or feel safe and comfortable, talk it out. Because I think that regardless of whether or not you continue with that therapist, that can be helpful for that person to express like, hey, these things don't make me feel comfortable in this relationship. Because I always tell my clients that I find that the therapeutic relationship often mimics personal relationships in the sense that the things that you struggle with are likely going to come out in your relationship with me. And so if you struggle to communicate boundaries or your feelings or whatever that might look like, that's probably going to end up here at some point. Right. And so if it's a situation that feels comfortable, I would say open up the floor to say like, hey, these things don't make me feel comfortable, or I wish that our sessions contained more of X, Y, and Z or less of X, Y, and Z. If it doesn't feel comfortable, then I would recommend switching therapists. But I also think it's really important to interview your therapist, because as much as, you know, you want their help, you also, you know, want to be sure that this is someone that you not only can get along with, but has the like skills and qualifications and personality traits and all of that that would be helpful for you. And so I would always say like, don't be afraid in the consultations to ask them a bunch of questions, ask them about the way that they practice or how they would deal with certain situations, because, you know, they should be able to answer those things. And if they can't, then that might not be the person for you.
Right. No, that's really, really helpful. I think that's something that I wish I had heard like maybe a couple years ago when I was going through that. Therapy is not like attainable for a lot of people too. And so if someone can't, like obviously we're going to say Dive Through apps, great. But for someone who doesn't have access to therapy, who's maybe there's like stigmas in culture about why therapy is something you should or shouldn't do, what would you say to someone who's kind of like struggling to find help, but like has all these blocks about getting the help?
Yeah. I mean, I think it depends on exactly what the barrier might be. So if it's, for example, a financial barrier, then that's something that's huge, because obviously we know that therapy isn't accessible for, I would say, like most people, especially long term. But if the barrier is financial, then starting at least with the resources that you can get yourself, whether that might be things from social media that you might find helpful, whether it's apps like Dive Through, like you mentioned, whether it's self-help books. If the barriers are, you know, cultural and familial, which is something that I also see a lot, I always like to remind people that people don't have to know where you're going. Mm-hmm. Or that you're seeing someone. And it's absolutely your choice if you decide to tell people that I'm in therapy. Mm-hmm. So you can tell people that you have an appointment or you're going wherever you go and keep that to yourself until mm-hmm. if and when you do feel comfortable. Mm-hmm. Because there is that stigma, especially like in the Black community and many racialized communities, around mental health and it being seen as a personal weakness versus mm-hmm. a health condition.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'd love to see that stigma change. Obviously, I want like everyone to receive the benefits of having a safe space to confide mm-hmm. with personal issues. So I'm really hoping that will change in the next couple years. You had brought up mm-hmm. like one form of therapy that you are registered with, or like that you have training with, called familial. Is it like constellations therapy or family?
Internal family systems.
Yeah, yeah. Can you share a little bit about that? Because I've always been curious what that type of therapy is.
Yeah, so essentially it's a way of looking at, you know, yourself and your experiences. So the way that I like to describe it is that we all kind of know maybe the feeling of like, part of me wants to go to the gym and the part of me wants to stay home and watch Netflix, right? And so it's kind of taking that sort of viewpoint of there's different parts of ourselves. So we all have kind of like a present day self, and then there's different parts of ourselves that, you know, are divided into protectors and exiles. And so our protectors are things that maybe we do on a day-to-day basis. So those would be our managers, so to speak, and things that we do on a day-to-day basis that help us not necessarily acknowledge really painful feelings. So the first thing that comes to mind is maybe people who always keep themselves busy, and that's just habitual mm-hmm. for them. So that would be kind of like a manager, so to speak. And that helps not sit in stillness, because mm-hmm. sitting in stillness likely would bring out some of those kind of like exiled parts, mm-hmm. which are parts that have been kind of burdened with trauma or hardships. Mm-hmm. And then our firefighters is, you know, another form of our protectors, which are more, you know, they happen as you go. So if something happens, like let's say, you know, we go on a date and maybe we get rejected, and that's a trigger for us, and that's something that potentially could bring out some of those exiled parts. Then our firefighter might say like, okay, let's go on a shopping spree, or let's go get drunk, or, you know, whatever else that might look like.
Okay.
And so it's really about creating relationships with all of those parts, really understanding where those parts come from, why they came to be, appreciating the jobs that they've done for so long, because it has been protective for you, and creating a relationship with the parts and the present day self, so that the parts feel confident and safe that present day self can deal with those things, and some of these parts don't have to come out.
Mm-hmm. So that kind of reminds me of that movie by Pixar. Is it Inside Out? Where you have like mm-hmm. the little people yeah. in the room, and then there's like yeah. the angry one, and then the other one. So yeah. it's kind of just like looking and compartmentalizing different aspects of yourself and being like, you know what, it's okay. So that kind of feels like inner child work, but like if you had like multiple children.
Yeah, 100%. Okay. Yeah. And especially because typically those parts are younger than you in some respect, right? And so mm-hmm. it's really about connecting, like, okay, if I have this really angry part and maybe this part is 7 years old, what does that part of myself need from me in order to feel safe? And sometimes creating that relationship takes a lot of time. Mm-hmm. And yeah. it can be very, very vulnerable.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, for sure. I can imagine that being a therapist can be very heavy at times. Like you are the safe space for like thousands of people to come through and like share what's on their hearts, and it's usually pretty heavy. Like people like to process when they're in tough times. Like what do you do to like keep your sanity and to keep your safe space and your personal boundaries when you're in the field of psychology?
Yeah, I think first and foremost, like, it goes back to my own therapy, because again, I think that if you're not aware of the things that impact you, then it's just gonna, you know, feel like a shit show essentially. And so I am very aware of the things specifically that might activate my emotions more than others. And so in those times, or with certain clients or whatever that might look like, how do I ground myself before and how do I take care of myself after? And so that might look like debriefing with a coworker, that might look like going for a walk, that might look like making sure that I am like nourished and hydrated throughout the day. So it's really just about taking care of yourself and prepping yourself for what situations kind of create that emotional activation, and how do I take care of myself?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, No, that's really, really wise. I think it's probably like a lot harder in practice when things are really heavy to have those boundaries. Mm-hmm. But like the fact that you have your foundations of things to go to, like, okay, let's check in with our body. Like, are we hungry right now? Or do we need to expel this energy? I think that's really, really smart. And I think that's practical information for people too, who are kind of that safe space for people in their lives and they're not necessarily therapists. Like, I think me having this podcast, I do get a lot of people asking me questions about things that I definitely am like going through as well. So just being able to like develop strong boundaries, but also like, I do want to be here and help. That's like a lifelong practice as well, it seems.
Oh, absolutely. Because I think at the end of the day, in order to show up for yourself, first and foremost, you need to be able to feel healthy and happy. And then after that, you can show up for other people. And so if I'm not doing the things that I need to do in order to take care of myself, I know I'm not going to be good at my job.
Have you ever gone through like during your time with therapy, have you ever gone through like a rock bottom where you needed to like really dive into the tools that you teach other people to like get out of like a heavy situation? Or yeah, that's what I'm trying to ask.
I think that every time I've hit maybe like a rock bottom or like maybe severe emotional activation, it's most of the time been in the therapy space, so that co-regulation helps. At other times, it definitely happens when I'm like by myself and whatever sometimes, and I think that I'm just gentle with myself depending on like the coping strategies I use, right? So at times it's just like, okay, I need a distraction and I'm gonna scroll through TikTok, and I don't think that's an inherently bad thing. I think it's just about, how often do I use this? I always avoiding my emotions. What does my relationship to that look like? So I think, you know, that reminds me of just the concept of, you know, being compassionate with yourself, because you're not going to use the coping strategies that feel helpful every single time. And that's fine.
Right. Yeah, that's right. We're looking for balance. I think perfectionism is probably something that pops up in this work a lot too, because you're giving people tools for what they can do and people probably freak out if they're not able to like use them successfully every time. My therapist does ART with me, which is the it's kind of the version of EMDR. And so she has me like do this thing with my hands where I'm like looking, and I forget to do it all the time, or like the 5-4-3-2-1, like I forget that. Or something I've noticed too is that like last week when I was so dysregulated, I was like, okay, well, I know that breath work would be very helpful right now. But because my mind was like, I could not meditate, I could not do breath work, I was just like, okay, I'm just gonna like do what feels good. And that was like watching reality TV and just like being compassionate towards like, you can't be perfect all the time. You have these tools, you can use them if it feels doable or not. But yeah, I think like me coming from a black and white space, I'm always like, I have to do this, I have to do this, like, I, you know, and it's tough. It's not super fun always.
Yeah. And I think that that's definitely something that I've seen a lot in just like, as mental health education and all that kind of stuff continues to grow, people are like, okay, well, I need to be securely attached all the time. I need to make sure that I'm coping well all the time. I need to do this all the time. But again, it's just about that balance. We're human. We're not going to do things correctly or helpful all the time, and that's absolutely fine. It's more so about your relationship to when you do those things that maybe you don't find as helpful, are you able to be compassionate with yourself and say like, okay, I needed that in that moment, and maybe next time I'm going to try something else.
Yeah, no, that's amazing. Okay, so on this podcast we talk a lot about purity culture and religious trauma. Is there like, have you experienced things with purity culture that have popped up in your life or clients' lives, and like, what advice would you give for someone who has been dissociated from their bodies?
Yeah, I think that if I were to speak about kind of like my own experience with purity culture, I think what I perhaps would have needed is more education about, because I mean, obviously we all get sex ed and all of that kind of stuff, but I think having more education about, you know, what happens in your body and what is natural and normal versus what is a preference of whether it's the church or your parents or whoever else, right? And so understanding that, you know, abstinence for sure can be a preference, but it doesn't have to be the standard for everybody. And if that isn't your standard, that doesn't make you less of a person or make you undeserving of love or connection or any of those things, right? And so making sure that you really understand, like, okay, you know, when I feel attracted to someone, or, you know, feelings of sexual attraction, all of that kind of stuff, that is absolutely normal. And it's okay to feel those things. It doesn't need to be a shameful experience. And so I think that education is so, so, so vital. And I also wish that that was something that happened in schools, was understanding like, okay, these are the things that happen in your body, and also focusing on the female experience as well, because we are often focused on the male experience and reproduction and all that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, when we were at school, I don't remember. I know that there was like a sex ed week through, I don't know what class it was, but it was like, it was by the same teacher who did the leadership class. I think she also had like a health class. Maybe it was just like, do you remember? But my experience with sex education, I went to Menno Simons Christian School before, mm-hmm. and then I went to CCS after. So my experience with sex education was that at MSCS, my teachers decided that they were just going to compile all of sex education into the grade 9 year. So that's not like how it's supposed to be. It's supposed to go 7, 8, 9. And so what happened was my class went through 7, 8. And then in grade 9, our teacher who was doing that class changed. And so a new teacher came in and was like, so you guys have been doing sex education for the past couple years. And we were like, no. And she was like, well, we only have budgeted 1 week, so I'm just going to stick with the curriculum that we were told. So we didn't really, like, get sex ed. And then, so, that 1 week obviously wasn't enough. It was like, I remember they invited a woman in, and she was like, this is the different types of kissing. Like, that was, like, basically it. It was, like, that and some, like, Hershey kisses in a paper bag, symbolic of STDs. So, like, that's the only thing that I got. And then went to CCS, and I remember it was a little bit more there, but it was still, like, nobody ever, like, the first time I saw someone, like, educate someone about how to put a condom, like, on a banana, that wasn't until I was in college, or, like, other things, too. And it's very frustrating to, like, grow up in the system where that information is, like, denied to you, you know, and you have to go out and find that yourself. And purity culture is, like, such a huge topic. Like, it's very big. It's impacted a ton of people. And just, like, I want people to feel empowered to get educated themselves. Do you work with anyone who, like, might be a good resource in terms of, like, sex education? Or, I don't know, what do you think about that?
That's a good question. There's nobody that comes to mind right away, but I definitely agree. I think that sex education is so, so vital, because regardless of the decisions that anybody chooses to make, I think that education just needs to be had for everyone, because I think that there's also a lot of danger in not really understanding not only the way that your body works, but also just the basics around, you know, sex education, how sex works, all of that kind of stuff. Because if you do choose to, you know, have sex and all of that kind of stuff, I think it's really important to be able to make informed decisions based on the education that you do receive, rather than feel shameful around, like, okay, I don't really know what's going on. I don't really know why my body's feeling this way, or what happens with this, or, you know, like, the different looks of different genitalia and all of that kind of stuff. Because I think that everything, especially in, you know, religious institutions, can be hidden a lot.
Yeah.
And these are our bodies.
These are our bodies. I love that. It's very true. I think, like, if I can see one theme that ties everything together, it's really, like, unwinding shame and looking where shame pops up in our life, and where we can start to grow in self-worth, where shame has, like, taken precedent. And it's like, really cool to talk to you, like, 10 years later and, like, hear what you're doing, see, like, your growth on Instagram and stuff, too. That, like, did that take you by storm that you, like, had such a huge growth on Instagram? Or, like, how was that experience for you?
Yeah. So I started my Instagram in December 2019. And I was kind of, like, fairly consistent with it, semi-consistent with it for the first part of, like, 2020. And then when it really took off was when I joined TikTok in last February. And so, like, my TikTok kind of took off, and then my Instagram subsequently took off after that. So I was very surprised about it. Yeah, it was definitely something that was shocking, because I had sort of a plan for my career and what I was going to do. And I wanted to do private practice, but initially I was like, okay, I'm going to work kind of, like, for Alberta Health Services for, like, this period of time, and then I'm going to slowly open private practice. And then last year I was kind of, like, waiting for the interview of the job that I wanted to get, and it was taking quite some time. And in that month, everything kind of popped off, and like, emails were coming in. And so I was just like, do I take the leap? And so I just did, and never looked back. And so it's been great.
That's amazing. I work at a digital marketing agency, so we're, like, always trying to find ways to, like, get clients on TikTok and, like, get them to pop off and the whole thing. But, like, I'm a huge believer of energetics now. Like, I'm like, oh, the universe is like doing its thing and like all the stuff. Yeah. And I just think like sometimes you get redirected from your path and it's something way better, something that you couldn't imagine before. And so it's just been like really cool to see what you're doing. And so I'm assuming that you're full time doing social media and dive through. And do you have a personal practice, like a private practice, or no?
Yeah. So that's my full time job right now. So social media kind of has been previously like kind of the driver for the practice. So now it's me and a team of, there's six of us now in my practice, which is really great. So there is four other therapists and there's one person who's like the media and operations manager. And yeah, the practice kind of just continues to grow. And so that's really exciting.
Oh, I'm so excited. I'm so stoked that we could have this conversation today. I know I like really picked your brain on so many topics and like
loved it.
It just is exciting because this is like the language that I feel like in another life I would like to be a psychologist or like busy. I just love the body. Like, I think it's like really fascinating. And so for you to be on here and to share your wisdom, I think it's just going to be amazing for the listeners. And I'm hoping that like we can continue to chat and have these conversations. And of course, I'll link like all your information below and everything.
Yeah, absolutely. Anytime. Thank you so much for reaching out. It was so good to hear from you and it's so good to see you again. Mm-hmm. And yeah, this conversation was super interesting and fruitful.
I actually have like one more question for you if you're down. Yeah. The question is, if you could go back to like your younger self before you had therapy on the mind, on the table, what advice would you give yourself?
Ooh. I think what comes to mind is you're not being dramatic. And to give context behind that, I think that at times when I was younger and dealing kind of with my own mental health stuff, I worried that I was maybe doing things for attention sometimes. And now that I'm older and have gone through therapy and like have been like educated about all of this kind of stuff, I think that even if the perception is that someone is doing something for attention, that's still important to look at because they're seeking connection of some degree or support of some degree. And so I think that, yeah, that's a great question, first of all. But yeah, I definitely think like you're not being dramatic is the thing that comes to mind.
Mm-hmm. I can see that. That's really, really beautiful, actually. Very stunning.
Thank you.
Very
cool. Thank you.
Okay, well, thank you, Simone, for everything. Yeah, I will leave your information below. If people want to get in contact with you, are your DMs open or is there a better way to reach you?
I would say via my website, and then there's kind of a contact form there. And so that's www.thecognitivecorner.ca.
Cool. Okay, great.
Thank you so much.
Well, thank you so much. We will catch up another time, and I hope you have like the best rest of your day.
You too.
Bye.